Hello, and welcome to another episode of the AP Biology podcast. I'm Ryan Scopehammer, and today I'm thrilled to welcome my guest, Bryce Taylor. Bryce is a scientist from the University of Washington. Hi, Bryce.
Hey, Ryan.
Bryce and I know each other because of this yeast project to experimentally evolve them to become resistant to over-the-counter antifungals that we've been working on together for over 3 years now. It's like almost 4 years to the point where I first wrote Bryce, or first wrote Maitreya, the PI for the lab that he works in, asking if they would like to collaborate. So it's like it's such a long time. It's like almost half of the time I've been a high school teacher now I've been working with you, Bryce. It seems hard to believe.
Yeah, time really flies. It's been awesome.
So it's really cool. So Bryce has met WestRidge students over Zoom and Skype, and also we've had six students had the opportunity to go up to the lab 2 years ago to visit, and that's certainly something that we'd love to do again once we have the ability to do so. Anyway, I invited Bryce here today to talk about evidence for evolution. So Bryce, tell us, like, what is your interest in evolution?
So I got started studying evolution kind of randomly back in graduate school. I was always interested in evolution. I grew up in an area where it was a very controversial topic, and I was really drawn to that and just wanted to know what's the truth, like who's right in this discussion. So it was always an interest as I was going through my early career in biology, like going high school and college. When I got to grad school, I was studying genetics in Saccharomyces cerevisiae, the budding yeast that we work with, and kind of just stumbled into some interesting genetic phenomena that related to evolution, and it made me realize that I could go deeper into that and decided to do a postdoc in an evolutionary biology lab.
Yeah, I had a very sort of similar path in that sense to evolution, because when I was in high school, it was not like emphasized, at least the way that I emphasize it in my classes. It's like, here's a thing, and it's very controversial, and I'm going to teach it. And the teacher was very clear about how and why it was necessary, and also like her own sort of personal beliefs. But like that was all a part of teaching it. And I think when I went to college, and I asked one of the profs like what major I should do. So there's like a variety of life science majors, and I asked like, oh, should I do molecular biology or should I just do like biology? Because those were like the two main choices. And she said, really, you should do biology because it's the only one that makes you take evolution as a class. And so like I really got into it after that class. So I took that advice and I did the biology major, and I just like, that was when I really got into it as an idea. And I think it's always really appealed to a lot of my non-science thinking as well. But I just like the importance and the elegance of evolutionary thought stuck with me after that point. So I also studied, evolution as a researcher when I was doing research.
That's a funny point that it wasn't part of the molecular biology curriculum, because now I don't know if we'll get into this later in the podcast, but evolutionary thinking is really taking over molecular biology and changing how we approach that field, and leading to a lot of really cool insights that I don't think we would have come to otherwise. So it kind of comes full circle, I guess.
Yeah, it's interesting because like my school had a molecular evolution class, which you could take as an elective, right, for either one of those majors. But in terms of like basic intro to evolution, it was like an ecology evolution class, which they often, get put together in those intro classes. And yeah, they just didn't make you take it if you were a molecular biology. But yeah, things have changed. I remember I was like, I kept all of my work from undergrad, and I was going through it a couple of years ago, and it was like, come up with an independent experiment for something. And I think that I had for my ecology evolution class, and I think that I had proposed doing some sequencing and building a tree. And then she was like, this would take years of work or something. This is from like 2000, yeah, I think definitely like,
That.
what's that?
Oh, now it's like a weekend.
Right, exactly. So I think like the technology change has certainly got a lot to do with that. So anyway, yeah, it is a really interesting point. I'm sure that it's different now. Okay, so given that we're talking about the new technologies, right, and how evolution has taken over molecular biology, what are the, to you, the most compelling or most interesting pieces of evidence that we have supporting evolutionary theory?
Yeah, so to me, it's all about the DNA sequences. When I was in high school in 2006 taking AP Bio, it was really hard to get DNA sequences. Like you could do, there were some technologies out there. Now, the amount of DNA sequence you can generate in a single day is like something that when I was in high school would have taken years to do at a tremendous cost. And as we've sequenced more organisms, you can line up the DNA from different organisms and just see how one came from the other, or how they're related. Organisms that are really closely related, like if you sequence two people, there might be a million differences scattered across their genome, but that comes out to like 0.1%. And then you sequence a chimp and line it up, and you can see there's just a few more differences. And then you sequence something further out, like a pig. And there's just a few more differences per segment of DNA that you look at. And so I find that to be really compelling evidence that for a long time before sequencing was widely available, people were just making inferences based on how similar two organisms were and trying to group them together. And now when we add that DNA evidence on top, it just perfectly matches up with a lot of that prior evidence, but really reinforces it and gives a much greater depth to the insights that we can have.
Yeah, I think a really, one really cool thing about sequence data is that it allows us to test a lot of our hypotheses about, say, whether two organisms share a trait because they share evolutionary history or because they shared similar environmental circumstance. So it's like a really cool test of things like convergence. So like, even though dolphins and fish look like very similar, they're streamlined for ocean living. Like we understand that a dolphin is a mammal and that a fish is not, and that they're not particularly closely related, but we can actually find that evidence in the molecular record now, showing you like, here are the things that dolphins are actually most closely related to, and that any of those similarities that we see are not because they share an evolutionary history. And you can do that. That's like a very dramatic example, but like you can do that in more sort of like more granular ways too.
Yeah, and I think the other powerful bit of evidence is that along the lines of the research that we've been doing together, if you look at two individuals from the same species, there's a finite number of genetic differences between them, but it's still a lot when you add it up. Like between people, it's on the order of millions of differences between two people. So you might think like that's, it's way more than we could ever look at in the lab. But you can kind of start from a, if you start from a smaller time scale and look at what we do with yeast, if you select on a trait, you can select for mutations that lead to differences in that trait. And you can watch the yeast evolve over short periods of time. And the types of events that occur in those experiments are the exact same types of events that distinguish much further related organisms. So like in our yeast evolution experiments, in a year, we might get something like 20 differences between two yeast at the end. If you go pick some yeast out of the wild, there might be tens of thousands of differences, but it's the same types of differences. And so you could imagine if you extrapolate that 1 year experiment out to thousands of years, you end up in the exact same spot that you find in nature.
Yeah, I think that's a really cool shift there too, is that given the revolution in molecular biology and sequencing, is that now the role of experimentation in investigating evolution is a lot more prominent than it used to be. So, what you talked about in the beginning, sort of like taking sequence data and doing alignments, lining it up and looking at the differences. And now what you're talking about is, okay, instead of doing that, what we're going to do is we're going to run an experiment where, based on how we set it up, we predict that evolution will occur. And then we can go through and verify that and interrogate, well, what changes have actually occurred using molecular technology. So why don't you, if you have more to say about sort of the role of experimental evolution, and sequencing in general in our current understanding, or just in how evolution is researched today.
Yeah, I think so there are lots of different ways to do an evolution experiment in the lab. The one we've done is just propagating a microbe for a while. If you have a large population of microbes, mutations happen. They're very rare within a test tube, but if you have billions of individuals, then they're enough, reliably enough. That they're going to eventually take over the population. Another way to do it is using natural variation. So if you take like a lot of work in fruit flies, for instance, you take two different groups of fruit flies from different areas and you mate them together. We'd refer to that as standing variation because like they already differ from each other. We're not looking for mutations, but you can see selection on regions of the genome over time if you grow them in a selective environment. And I think that those two together, looking at the role of new mutations that are changing the function of genes, and then looking at variation that already exists and how that can drive evolution in concert, really help us to understand how this is happening in the wild. And then the other thing is that using model organisms like yeast, we know what most genes in the yeast genome do. And that allows us, when we find a mutation, to study what the effect on that gene is. And one of the really interesting lines of research in my mind is seeing how gene functions can change over time and how single DNA letter changes in a gene can totally change what the encoded protein does. But in ways that are kind of predictable, like it's never like for instance, it might be an enzyme that breaks down one sugar and a mutation allows it to break down a different type of sugar. And if you go out and sequence different species that maybe differ in their ability to eat different sugars, you can see it's the exact same types of changes that are happening in the wild that we can select for in the lab. So again, it's like we're doing very short-term experiments. But the types of phenomenon we're seeing at the genetic level are identical to what's happening in nature.
I think like another thing that you just brought up that I think is a really important piece for us when we're studying evolution is that concept of model organisms, and that the fact that all living things share a common ancestry provides the basis for you to use model organisms to investigate processes, right? So something like yeast can be a good model organism for eukaryotes. So for how does a eukaryotic cell behave, and we can use yeast to understand that. And then a fruit fly, as you mentioned, again, like is a model for animals potentially. So I think that, and without that common ancestry, without evidence of that, we wouldn't be able to use these other organisms in experiments, and expect that we could draw conclusions that could be applied broadly to larger groups of organisms.
One really cool tidbit along those lines that blew my mind when I just learned this like a few years ago. Is that when the Human Genome Project happened, one of the primary goals was to sequence other organisms too. So the funding that went to the Human Genome Project also covered sequencing things like yeast and flies and mice. And they were able to line up those DNA sequences. And right now we know we have a function for something like half of human genes. And almost all of that information we know comes from figuring out what it did in a model organism, doing one of those alignments, and then validating it in humans. So you're not starting from scratch, you're just confirming what has been done in other organisms. And it almost always checks out, like the function's almost always conserved.
Yeah. All right, Bryce. Well, thank you so much for coming and talking with me today. Do you have any closing thoughts on evidence for evolution or anything else you'd like to say to my students?
One thing we didn't talk about is the history of evolutionary biology. I do think it's pretty interesting to go back and look at some of the early evidence. Like we said, the DNA sequence is what's really worked for us in convincing us of evolution. But I think it's kind of cool to look at the origins. Like, if you go back to Origin of Species, the Charles Darwin book that was really one of the like keystone points early in the field. There's some pretty fascinating stories around it. Like he got started basically as a travel guidebook writer. He traveled the world and was writing cool stories about it. And along the way, just started making these observations that he collected into this book that changed how we think about science. So yeah, I don't know. I think the history can be kind of fun if you're into it.
Yeah, I think one of the other interesting things to me about Darwin was that he was a pigeon breeder, right? And he kept pigeons. So he had this analogy from his pigeon breeding and other sort of livestock breeding that he used to form the basis of natural selection, which is another like, sort of a bunch of accidental forward experimental evolution projects by humanity, prior to understanding what exactly that was. But the principles are exactly the same. Okay, well, Bryce, I'm sure that I'll hear from you again on this. So, I'll wrap it up here, but thanks again.
Yeah, thanks.